Well, let's talk about Blueprints of the Afterlife. Can you, without giving too much away, kind of describe the storyline?
Sure. So Blueprints of the Afterlife takes place over two periods in history, one in the future, which is a period that happens after a series of cataclysmic events that are so horrible and apocalyptic that no one really understands what exactly happened. And so the survivors of that period, the people who came out the other side of it, are all sort of standing around scratching their heads, trying to determine what it is exactly that went down. And the other period is more or less contemporary time, starting in the early 90s. And it's in the form of a Q&A interview with this guy named Luke Piper, who grew up in the Pacific Northwest, where a lot of the novel in both time periods takes place. And the action of the novel sort of coalesces around a recreation of Manhattan that's being built on Bainbridge Island, which is in Puget Sound, which is about a half-hour ferry ride from Seattle. And over the course of the novel, the characters sort of convene on this island and learn more about just what's going on in their world.
Boy, that's a concise representation of something that really isn't a concise story at all. You know, one of the things that interests me about this future that you've created is that it's not your usual post-apocalyptic future. It's a much more settled, high-tech future,
right,
than we usually get. I mean, usually it's Cormac McCarthy's out in the desert trying to survive on roots and berries, and that's not
right.
This at all.
Right. It's more, I thought about what I could contribute to the great tradition of post-apocalyptic literature, which I loved as a kid. I loved Stephen King's The Stand and the Mad Max movies. And my idea was that, well, you know, a lot of that stuff's been done. You know, the people trekking across a wasteland is sort of a, you know, Cormac McCarthy basically perfected it. You don't even need to try anymore after reading The Road if you're going to go that route. But so what I decided to do was I thought, well, you know, what would happen if after an apocalypse, everything kind of rebounded a bit? And what would the survivors think? And if things get back to, you know, more or less good times. And the two technologies that I introduce as part of this future scenario are something called the BioNet, which is a sort of a biological internet which allows people to upload immunities and download medicine from sort of a cloud technology that no one really fully understands. And then there's another technology called Q-Puters, which are quantum computers that tend to alter the fabric of reality.
Again, you've come up with some pretty wild ideas, but they're based on things we know. I mean, talking about the BioNet, it's extraordinary, but when you place it in the context of the internet, I guess it makes sense.
Yeah, you know, I thought about the BioNet as something that, you know, I've known people who have studied medicine or naturopathic medicine or different medical traditions, and I've sort of looked around at the ways, say, Eastern cultures look at the body and medicine, and it's different. It's a different modality than Western medicine. And I thought about, you know, what I know about digital information technology, and I kind of combined those two things and thought, well, you know, the next phase might be that we are able to download things from sort of an internet into our bodies, and that we're able to overcome illnesses by, you know, downloading an immunity that someone else developed in their body. And so that became kind of fascinating to me. And
I mean, it sounds kind of utopian on the surface, but when you get into it, you can see that there are aspects of it that have some problems. I mean, they're good. There are other good things. Some of the characters in the novel seem to have the ability to offload bad memories, for instance.
Right. So, you know, like with any technology, the BioNet in this novel has a number of people who abuse it. So there are people called DJs who basically take over other people's, you know, physiological systems and hack them. So, for instance, if you are a, you can opt into this. You can choose to be DJ'd, and you basically become sort of an avatar of yourself in a way. And then there, you know, there are individuals in the book, one in particular, who does offload his bad memories. I mean, you, with the BioNet, you know, longevity has been extended. So there are people who live to, you know, 200 years. And this one character named Skinner went through a lot of the horrible cataclysmic events that precede the novel. And so in order to be sane and to survive, he's had to offload a lot of his memories. But he's sort of obsessed with finding out what it is that he forgot.
You can see that when the rest of the world doesn't know what happened, and he knows that he once knew, it would be kind of terrifying.
Yeah, he lives sort of burdened by these memories and haunted and unable to really move forward until he's processed them. And there's other people who've gone beyond them and just sort of, you know, they've offloaded their memories and they're fine. They're you know, they're perfectly happy living in ignorance of what it is they experienced in the past. But for some reason, he's sort of obsessed, and he wants to return again and again to these events in order to uncover the truth of what happened in his life.
Is that also why, in part, the full-scale replica of Manhattan is being built in Puget Sound? I mean, in a way, it sounds like trying to rebuild the past in a different place.
Right. And one of the things that happens with this replica of Puget Sound is that there are people who are drawn to it, who show up, you know, on its shores and enter this new Manhattan. And what happens to them when they get there is they start having dreams and start adopting the identities of people who lived in the real Manhattan, you know, over a century before. And so they start, you know, dreaming that they're someone else who lived in Greenwich Village, say, and they start becoming the people that lived in Manhattan before it was destroyed in some sort of ambiguous event.
I read somewhere that you actually dreamed up this replica of Manhattan first, before any of the characters in the novel.
Yeah, well, the reason, you know, when you grow up in Washington State and you take Washington State history class in high school, one of the first things you learn is that the early settlers who came to Seattle, one of their early ideas was to call their settlement New York Alki, which means by and by in Chinook. In other words, that their little muddy village would someday be as big as Manhattan. And then the other thing you learn is that Bainbridge Island is about the same size as Manhattan. So I kind of put these two ideas together and I thought, well, you know, maybe in this novel, at least, I can finally make Seattle Manhattan through this process. And I just was fascinated by the idea of building a whole city on an island. And my father is a civil engineer, and so I would ask him these sort of speculative questions about what it is you would have to do in order to recreate Manhattan on Bainbridge. And it was a lot of fun inventing that.
Well, part of what appealed to me about that idea is that you created this city and then peopled it. And in a sense, you have that same thing happening again in the novel, this kind of outside-inside stuff going on, and the people acquiring other people's memories as though they lived in the original Manhattan. You're almost making fun of yourself doing that.
I suppose so. Yeah, you know, I find that, you know, and when I was writing the book, writing that part, when I got to that part in the novel, I knew that I had to have the characters show up in Manhattan. I couldn't just mention it offhand early in the novel and then not use such a cool setting. I had this thing sort of off to the side that people refer to, but you didn't really get a glimpse of it until, say, the last 100 pages of the book. And so when I got to that part at the end, as I was writing it, the thing that I didn't anticipate was the whole notion of people taking on other people's identities, which fit in to some of the other themes that were going through the novel, particularly as they relate to a character named Abby Fogg, who has this strange feeling that she's not herself throughout the book, and she's sort of struggling to understand her identity, and she doesn't exactly feel like she belongs in this era or this world.
I mean, I wonder if you would read a little bit. There's a point at which she says that, when you say of her that, there's a section on page 70?
Sure.
About Abby Fogg. If you'd read that, that would be great.
Sure. So this is the first chapter in which she appears. So this is her introduction. Ever since childhood, Abby Fogg had wondered why she was herself instead of somebody else. She'd lie on her bedroom floor, staring at the circle within a circle within a circle of the ceiling light fixture, freaking herself out with the fact that she was Abby Fogg. And while this Abby Fogg accumulated thoughts and memories, went to college, fell in love with archival films and a man named Rocco Patrone, the suspicion persisted that there'd been some mistake, that somehow Abby Fogg had been dropped into the wrong body. Since the age of 5 or 6, Abby had suspected she'd been born in the wrong era, aching as she watched the grain of early 20th century footage. But the previous century wouldn't have her, with its artist salons and movie palaces and celebrity sex tapes. Nope, Abby had been born into this era yet to be named, and the years that followed that dark period known as the fuss. Nowadays, Abby rose early to make breakfast and spy on her neighbors from the Vancouver condo she shared with Rocco. Even though the place had a view of Granville Island, she preferred to sit in her undies in the dining nook, where she could read the news and glance through horizontal blinds angled at the precise diagonality to allow her a view into a condo across the courtyard and 3 stories down. The occupants of this condo are about the same age as Abby and Rocco, maybe a little older, not yet sinking into their 30s. The couple bore the same demographic characteristics as Abby's parents, she Asian, him sort of Latino-ish Caucasian. The woman usually rose first around 6:30 a.m., mounted a green football in her panties and tank top, drank coffee from an ugly brown mug, caught up on email. The guy rose about half an hour later, shirtless, a landing strip of chest hair marking his sternum. He shuffled into the living room workspace, scratching himself through plaid pajama bottoms, planted a kiss on his girlfriend's neck, and performed a few push-ups and stomach crunches on the rug. The woman worked at home, doing something design-related. The man left around 8:30 for a job that didn't require him to wear a tie, but sometimes he wore a collared shirt and a sport coat with jeans. Abby suspected these were days in which the man met with clients, whoever they might be.
You know, part of the fascination of that is, again, the then and now. It is, one suspects, very ordinary now for exactly that kind of thing to be a morning routine for anybody. But you have that clear sense also that Abby Fogg may be right, that she isn't Abby Fogg.
Right, right. I wanted there to be a lot of ambiguity from the very beginning that perhaps she wasn't actually in control of her identity. And so as she proceeds through the novel, she finds really more and more about the root of that feeling.
And the other character, I mean, there are a lot of other characters, but one of the other main characters is Luke Piper. You said he's in our time.
Correct, correct. More or less, yeah. And he exists sort of at the end of the 20th century, bridging the 21st. And his sections take place in the form of a Q&A interview.
I was curious about that. Why the Q&A?
You know, honestly, I came to that idea after reading Haruki Murakami's Kafka on the Shore, in which there are sections which take place in the form of almost a report or a dry sort of sections that punctuate the regular narrative. And I like the idea of having something tonally different between these sections that happened in the distant future that would be in the form of an interview. And I also found that having it being an interview would allow me to do a lot of the things I would normally do with a first-person narrative, but sort of position it differently because I have this other person interrogating him.
You also, you put a little distance in. You don't have the omniscient narrator at that point. So while you perhaps trust everything Luke is saying, there is the fact that he's saying it and you don't know for sure whether he means it.
Right, right. There's a lot of ambiguity about whether his version is the correct version. And there are parts that he, you know, as his story unravels, it gets increasingly fantastical. To the point where the interviewer starts expressing skepticism about his version of events.
Yeah.
But, you know, while you're reading that, there you've been also reading about things like giant heads floating in the sky of this future world. And so I liked the tension of having a more or less realistic setting that slowly turns into something very strange.
Well, I read somewhere that you wanted to see how far you could push it, the weird inside the normal, and but still hold the story together.
Yeah, it was important to me to have, you know, the characters in the novel experience real emotions and have and be able to have this, you know, generate a sense of empathy between the characters and the readers. But at the same time, I did want to go as crazy as I possibly could. I wanted to write something that was like nutty and bizarre and sort of indulged, like a lot of stuff that I love about literature when it gets just, you know, goes off the rails and you're wondering what's real and what's not. But I wanted to ground it in actual characters' concerns and sort of strike a balance between those two things.
Well, I mean, there's a real surreal. That's a funny way to say it, isn't it? There is a surreal quality to parts of it, like the scenes in which Abby Fogg's gone to work with a pop star and an army of clones.
Right.
And they do a show that recreates her visits, and then there's a show that recreates the show. It's like mirrors reflected in mirrors reflected in mirrors.
Right, right. I mean, so Abby, I mean, when she gets sent to a mansion, which is basically the Empress Hotel in Victoria, B.C., but in the future. And now it is being occupied by this 200-year-old aging pop star named Kylie Asparagus, who's surrounded herself with over 600 clones of her favorite backup dancer who tend her every need. And so Abby is navigating this weird world, and then they do stage a version of her life, and they produce it and show it to her about, you know, what she's been doing for the last couple months and up to the point of her actually watching the show, at which point there's a show within a show, and it keeps going and going. And I have to admit that I sort of stole this idea from a Bjork video that I watched that was directed by Michel Gondry, the great French video director and filmmaker. In which Bjork goes through this sort of experience. She goes to a theater and watches a production of what you've just been watching, and then it mirrors in on itself and sort of becomes like an M.C. Escher kind of theatrical experience.
I can hear you smile as you talk about this. I'm guessing from that you had a grin from ear to ear as you were writing it.
I had a lot of fun writing it. I really enjoyed it, and it was funny because a lot of it was very difficult to write in the sense of you know, managing my time and working a full-time job and also having a newborn in the house and teaching on top of that. But I found that I would write when I had little pieces of time here and there, like a lunch break or something, and I think approaching it with a real sense of fun and enjoying myself enabled me to get through to the end and not trying to be really important or trying to be serious, but enjoying myself as much as possible and really indulging in things that I thought were funny or crazy or weird.
Well, there's also that sense from time to time of the author being outside. There's that kind of surreal nature to your novel. There's a line at one point you say of Abby Fogg, she yearned for a plot, but instead absurdity after absurdity had been thrown before her, absurdities that alluded to obscured purposes. You get the real dreamlike quality of it there, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to kind of tip my hat to readers in that passage where, you know, I realize it's almost like saying, yeah, I know things are completely bonkers here, but just follow me, you know, and just stick with me here for a minute, folks, as, you know, things become completely confusing, because there are parts of the novel that remain confusing to me, and there are parts that I still don't know. Like, I still don't know the identity of the person who's interviewing Luke. I don't know who that person is, and I didn't want to know, and I felt that it was more fun to not know than to have a big explanation. I've always sort of recoiled from art that kind of tries to explain everything away in the last act and tie it up with a bow, and I didn't want that. It was more important to me to write something that could be experienced than understood necessarily.
I'm a little curious about your influences. I'm wondering, Dave Eggers described you as some kind of new and dangerous cross between Kurt Vonnegut and Donald Barthelme. Have you read Kurt Vonnegut and Donald Barthelme?
Yes. Yeah, I have. I've read both those authors. Kurt Vonnegut, the first book I read by him was Galapagos, and I remember reading it maybe when I was 13 or 14 years old. And I remember that by like 100 pages in, I was completely offended by his tone, and not that in terms of the subject matter, but that he was doing things like saying, I'm going to put an asterisk next to the name of every character who's going to die in the next 50 pages. And I remember thinking, you can't do that. But then by the end of the book, I was so won over. I thought, that is brilliant. I love that. And so I've doled out my, you know, Vonnegut over the years. I read Breakfast of Champions in high school. And then just a couple years ago, finally read Slaughterhouse-Five, and then read some essays and stories that he's written. But he's really brilliant. I love he's a giant, and I love his work. And Barthelme, too. I had an intense Barthelme infatuation in graduate school. As far as like other influences, I suppose, you know, I was very taken with Thomas Pynchon when I was in college, and that turned quickly into a David Foster Wallace love, and Don DeLillo. And then within, you know, over the 90s, authors like Amy Bender and Rick Moody and, you know, a whole host of people. I've really tried to cast the net wide when it comes to literature and understanding that I'll never be able to read deeply into one particular tradition, but if I try to read a lot of different kinds of work, then hopefully that will inform my work in a meaningful way.
And it's not just writers either, is it? I've read some things that you've been influenced by film.
Yeah, I love film. For a time, I worked at Amazon.com from about 2004 to 2007, and I was a DVD editor there, and so that exposed me to a lot of film. I worked with movie studios on their releases and merchandising their releases on the website, and so I was exposed to a lot of great sort of auteur-driven cinema, a lot of experimental film, a lot of classics, and
anything in particular?
Yeah, so there are a couple directors. Well, I mean, basically, the Criterion Collection was my starting point. So, I mean, it's just a fantastic curated series of films that have come out from that company. And then, but for this particular book, there was a film that I kept looking at, and not in terms of its themes, but more its spirit. And that was this film by this Mexican director named Alejandro Jodorowsky. Actually, I'm not sure if he's Mexican. He might be Chilean. I can't remember. But Alejandro Jodorowsky, and he made this film called The Holy Mountain, which is crazy. It's just this bizarre film from 1970 that was financed by John Lennon and Yoko Ono that was just unbelievable. And it's one of those films where you watch it and you think, how did he possibly convince his actors to do that? You know, and the set design is incredible. It's just so over the top and visually brilliant. And it has that sort of crazy quality that I wanted to capture in my book, too.
That's a little like you're trying to go absurd while holding the thing together with rubber bands.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. You know, I think there's a danger when you're exploring surreal or strange or, you know, non-realist material to really frustrate your readers or your audience. And it can become self-indulgent really fast. And I think the key for me was always trying to understand what a reader's experience of the book would be like and to be very serious about catering to that without pandering and understanding that, you know, someone who's reading this is going to, there's certain sort of literary values that are timeless about wanting to be rewarded by a story arc. You know, we meet a character, they change, they come to resolution, and we have these certain very deep expectations about what those are. But within, you know, working within those expectations, there's still so much you can do to innovate. And I'm fascinated by that process, both sort of honoring the time-worn storytelling principles that make great literature, but also pushing it forward and into realms that it maybe hasn't ever gone into before.
I'm just curious, because you did say that you were influenced by those years you spent at Amazon watching films, whether you could imagine a film of Blueprints of the Afterlife.
Well, I can't. I could. You know, I think they'd have to strip away a lot of it. But I think if you were to make a film about Blueprints of the Afterlife, one thing that, I mean, if I were to give a director advice on how to do it, I would say, well, you focus in on Abby and Wu Jin. And I think that that would be the most.
Wu Jin is?
Wu Jin is a character who's a, he is a exceptionally gifted dishwasher. He is the greatest dishwasher in the world. And he has these attacks of empathy that sort of incapacitate him. And they cross paths in sort of an interesting way in the book. But and they both end up in Manhattan, in the New York Alki setting at the end too. So I think that those two characters would I would watch a movie with those guys.
Would you write it?
For sure. If someone wanted me to write it, I would listen to what they had to say. Yeah.
So what is next for you? And I hear there's another novel, The Mountains and the Valleys.
Right. So I'm working on another novel, and the sort of experiment that I'm running in my head about this next novel is that while Blueprints of the Afterlife is about a future and is sort of a head trip, I wanted this next novel to take place in the recent past and to look at different places I've lived and different eras that I've experienced, but from the point of view of characters who are unlike me. So, for instance, I went to college in Olympia, Washington, right during the grunge rock explosion, right, and the Riot Girl phenomena. And I was also, you know, in Seattle in the late 90s at the beginning of the dot-com boom. And so, you know, and was, you know, saw the WTO riots happen, you know, right outside the office I was working in and that kind of thing. So I wanted to look at these different periods and think about them, think about putting characters in them who are not sort of facsimiles of me, but are themselves and who are different than me, and thinking about those periods. And it's it feels like it wants to be a long novel. And I'm also working on, I still work on stories and essays, and hopefully, you know, I want to put together a couple books before the next novel comes out, of collections of stuff. But yeah, I'm always working, always hoping to best myself with the next project.
Well, we'll look forward to it. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks a lot. You're a good conversationalist. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And we'll talk to you again. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.